In the book, I assert that this economic growth that we've come to rely upon is in fact ending, and that it's doing so because of the convergence in real time of what I call the three D's: debt, depletion, and disaster, natural disaster and industrial accidents. And I'm going to unfold for you these factors for a few minutes. In order to understand the context of economic growth, I think we have to start with energy, because energy is the heart of the economy. Without energy, nothing happens. And over human history, most of our time has been spent using energy from the sun, harvested by green plants and nature, and processed through animals and ourselves and other humans. We've exerted energy into our environments, mostly through muscle power, either human muscles or the muscles of domesticated animals. And that meant that our economies grew only very, very slowly, if at all, because they were economies that were based on local renewable energy. Now, all of that changed over the course of the last 100, 150, 200 years, as we developed the ability to extract and use fossil fuels. We had known about fossil fuels for a long time previously, but it required the invention of metallurgy and gears and simple heat engines, steam engine, in order to be able to use fossil fuels. And once we gained that ability, all hell broke loose. One way to think about the power of fossil fuels is to remember the last time you ran out of gas in your car and had to push your car maybe 10 feet off to the side of the road. That's hard work. Now imagine pushing your car 30 miles down the road. That's really a lot of work. That's the equivalent of something like 10 weeks of hard labor, hard human work. We get that done for us, pushing a car 30 miles down the road, we get that done for us with a single gallon of gasoline, for which we're paying $4 and complaining. Now think about that. The energy equivalent of 10 weeks of hard labor for $4? What a bargain. It's because energy has been so cheap, so abundant, so concentrated over the past century or so, that we have replaced human labor with fuel-fed machines in so many instances. We've mechanized transportation and production in every way we possibly could, and that has given us enormous economic benefits. Over the past millennium or two, empires have risen and fallen, but really the total size of economic output of human societies on planet Earth has not changed that much until the last centuries or two, and suddenly it's practically off the charts. But of course, we're also talking about lots more people. So if we look at GDP per capita and the increase, then we also have to multiply that per capita increase in wealth by a sevenfold increase in capitas, because instead of 1 billion on the planet, as we had in 1800, we now have 7 billion human beings. So the total increase in wealth has been absolutely astounding just over the last couple of hundred years. Now, how did we use this abundance of cheap, concentrated energy? Well, in lots of ways. One way we used it was to start making more things, more consumer products. And we found that using powered assembly lines, we could make stuff faster than people could buy it. Now, in the early part of the 20th century, most people were still accustomed to buying things with cash. And big ticket items, especially like automobiles, were a big investment. Not many people were able to afford to buy a new automobile, like a new Studebaker or Model T. These things cost, roughly $1,000 That may not seem like much to spend on an automobile these days, but in 1910, $1,000 was a lot of money. Not many people had that much cash sitting around. So here was a problem. Powered assembly lines could make automobiles so fast and so abundantly that they could make enough for everybody to have one, but not many people could afford to buy one or even realize that they needed one. How to solve that problem? Two strategies. First, advertising. Talk people into wanting them really, really badly. And there were sub-strategies that went along with advertising, like planned obsolescence, you know, making stuff so that it would reliably break down after a certain amount of time so you'd have to replace it, or change its appearance every year or two so that everybody would want to have the latest Ford or iPad or whatever. And that turned out to be an enormously successful strategy. And over the decades, the advertising industry ballooned from this very, very small little appendage of society to an enormous industry that processes hundreds of billions of dollars a year and has changed the consciousness of human beings. The other strategy, besides advertising, that we deployed in order to enable more people to buy more stuff faster was consumer credit. Make it easier for people to go into debt to buy stuff now so that they could consume now and pay later, right? Pushing consumption forward in time. Again, this was a very effective strategy. And over the course of the 20th century, the total amount of consumer debt ballooned. Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, money was still connected with precious metals, gold and silver. But as the economy began to grow and grow and grow, it became apparent that there just wasn't enough gold and silver around to facilitate all the trade that otherwise could happen. So the solution to that was to decouple money from precious metals. And this is a process that worked its way out over the course of the 20th century. And by the mid-1970s, the last connections had been severed. And by this time, money was equivalent to debt. And this is strictly true. If you go into the bank and take out a loan, the banker doesn't, you know, let's say it's a loan of $10,000. The banker doesn't go into the vault and search around for $10,000 that happens to be sitting there that somebody else deposited. No, the banker enters a few keystrokes on the computer and calls $10,000 into existence that did not exist previously. This is how money is created, through the making of loans. Now, unfortunately, the interest that you're ultimately going to pay on that loan is not created at the same time. So how does this work? Where does the interest come from? Well, it comes from other people elsewhere in the economy also taking out loans, and then we're all doing business with one another one way or another, working for each other or selling stuff to each other. And as long as the total amount of debt is growing, then theoretically there should be enough new money being created all the time to repay the existing debt plus interest. The only problem happens if growth stops or the rate of growth declines below the interest rate. And then we run into a problem and we see lots of defaults occurring within society, folks who can't pay back their loans. So in effect, tomorrow's growth is collateral for today's debt. We all believe or want to believe that the economy can continue to grow into the indefinite future in order to stave off default and economic collapse, which would otherwise occur if we didn't have economic growth. So in effect, our entire economy has become a sort of pyramid scheme. Up until the 1980s, debt was growing just about as fast as GDP, and this was the perfect situation. Debt was growing, but as long as GDP was growing at the same rate, then the existing debt could always be repaid. Now, starting in the 1980s, things began to go a little haywire. What happened in the 1980s? Globalization began as a result of the introduction of container ships, satellite communications, computer monitoring of inventories. We began to see much higher volumes of international trade in commodities and manufactured goods. So this meant, in effect, that American workers were increasingly competing directly with workers in Mexico, China, and other countries. So this had the effect, of course, people in those countries were typically earning much less, so this had the effect of driving down wages for American workers, or putting downward pressure on those wages, so that hourly wages for American workers basically have been stagnant since the mid-1970s, on average. So here's a problem. If we require constant growth, and 70% of the economy by this time is consumer spending, and everybody wants to buy more stuff, we're still being advertised at 24/7. Everybody wants a bigger house and a bigger car and flat screen TVs and skis. And how are we going to make all of that happen? With more debt. And so over the course of especially the last 40 years, new ways of going into debt, more easier ways of going into debt, have been created by the financial industry. Credit cards have become, of course, ubiquitous. Lots more people owning their own homes, well, actually not owning them outright, but having mortgages. Right? Banks made it easier for people to take on mortgage debt. And then second mortgages and home equity lines of credit. So starting in the 1980s, debt is growing faster than GDP. Virtually every year, I think every year but two, since 1980, debt has grown faster than GDP. So what does this mean? It means the financial industry is growing. How so? Well, if you're taking out a loan, for you, the debtor, that loan is an obligation, right? But from the standpoint of the bank, that same loan is an asset. So as all of this debt is growing, this is, in effect, is providing the banks and the financial industry with enormous new assets, which they then leverage by means of new financial products that are traded only within the financial industry through securitization, derivatives. So the total amount of debt within the financial industry balloons. And the metaphor is very apt, because what starts to happen is the blowing of bubble after bubble, speculative bubbles. In the 1980s, there was the savings and loan debacle, and toward the end of the 80s, we had a real estate bubble, and then in the 1990s, we had an internet bubble, and then in the early 2000s, the biggest real estate bubble of all. And as the financial industry is growing in size relative to the rest of the economy, in comparison to manufacturing and farming and all the rest, it's also gaining political power. The financial industry is contributing more and more to the campaigns of politicians. And those politicians then repay that favor by deregulating the financial industry. Okay, so the financial industry had been laboring under some regulations that had been put in place all the way back in the 1930s in order to prevent the kinds of financial bubbles that happened in the 1920s that led to the Great Depression, right? So those regulations were removed, and as that happened, the bubbles that we started seeing in the 1980s and 90s and 2000s, each one got bigger until we got to 2008 and the biggest bubble burst of all. So this is a picture of U.S. debt from roughly 1980 to the present. And as you can see, all categories of debt have grown. We've been talking in this country and around the world for the last couple of years a lot about government debt and the problem of government debt. But as you can see, government debt for decades was not growing any faster than consumer debt or corporate debt or debt within the financial industry itself. It's only when we get to 2008 that suddenly other categories of debt start to decline and government debt starts to increase. So starting in 2008, virtually all new debt is in the public sector, government debt. So what's happening is that debt within the private sector is contracting. And remember, if that's all that's happening, then that means the economy is starting to feed on itself and will collapse. So in order to prevent that from happening, the government becomes the borrower and spender of last resort in order to keep that collapse from occurring. That's what happened in 2008-2009. Now, we've been talking a lot about economic growth. And we can't talk for long about economic growth without acknowledging the fact that there have been very intelligent people who've been warning us for some time that economic growth actually can't go on forever. This is a book that I read, The Limits to Growth. It was published in 1972, and it was the effort of a team of scientists to use computer modeling to depict the interaction between population growth, resource depletion, and environmental impacts. When they programmed this data into their software and their computer, the standard run scenario showed a peak and decline in world industrial output, i.e. economic growth, sometime in the first two decades of the 21st century. Well, when they saw that, they said, oh my gosh, this is horrible. What can we do? So they tweaked the scenario in various ways. They doubled Earth's resources in the input data. They programmed in government policies to reduce population growth or to rein in pollution. And by doing these things, they were able to push industrial collapse forward in time by a couple of decades, so that instead of occurring in 2020, it happened in 2050. Right? But the same basic scenario kept coming up again and again, no matter how they tweaked the input data. So we've been warned. We've been warned for some time. And in fact, it's intuitively obvious if economic growth has depended so much on cheap fossil fuel energy, we know that fossil fuels are finite. They are a non-renewable resource. Therefore, you know, we can argue about how long they'll last or what portions of the resource we may ultimately be able to extract using new technologies and so on. And of course, these are discussions that are going on all the time. But in the end, we're only talking about the margins. Sooner or later, we will find ourselves without fossil fuels. So the question is this a picture also of what's going to happen to the human economy and human population and all the rest? Well, nobody knows the answer to that question. You know, maybe we can develop renewable energy sources to enable us to keep growing or level off or make the decline curve more gentle. That's really the most important discussion of the 21st century. We know that fossil fuels are actually getting more scarce and expensive in real time. The discussion about fossil fuel depletion is not so much one of theory and forecast as just sort of noting what's going on. For the United States, this is mostly history. We were the first country to drill a commercial oil well back in 1859 in Pennsylvania. Okay, this is where the oil industry started. And I'm talking here mostly about oil because oil has become the most important of the fossil fuels. It's the most energy dense. And we use it for transportation, and transportation has become so central to our economy. Not only cars and planes, but also the transport of all the products and resources that are traded. So trade depends upon transport, and transport depends upon oil. Okay, U.S. oil discoveries peaked in 1930. And U.S. oil production peaked 40 years later in 1970. It's been going generally downhill ever since. It's not that we stopped looking. And in fact, huge new discoveries were made in the U.S. in the 1970s and 80s, first in Alaska, the North Slope of Alaska, and then deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico. These added little bumps on the downward slope, but they didn't change the overall trajectory. The U.S. peaked out at a little under 10 million barrels per day, and we're currently producing about 5.6 million barrels per day of crude oil. Now, the same thing is happening in other countries around the world. World oil discoveries peaked in 1964. Again, it's not that we've stopped looking, and it's not that we have stopped finding oil. Oil is still being found in offshore, off the coast of Brazil, in the Gulf of Guinea, off West Africa, in Arctic regions. We're developing new technology to scrape the bottom of the barrel more effectively. The Bakken Shale in North Dakota, it's a big success story, producing 400,000 barrels of oil in North Dakota. Who would have thunk? Of course, if you're using 18 million barrels of oil per day, 400,000 barrels, it helps, but it's not going to make you oil independent. That's not going to make up for all the oil that we're importing now from Canada and Venezuela and all those other countries. But the problem is that those other countries that we're importing oil from, they're also seeing the same process happen. This is a slide from the International Energy Agency, and all those nice colored bars, that's all of the oil that we know about. It's conventional oil, unconventional oil, OPEC oil, non-OPEC oil, and as you can see, right about 2012, all of those nice colored bands just start dropping off. But not to worry, because the International Energy Agency assures us that we'll still be able to continue growing world oil supplies from unidentified projects. Now, we don't know what those projects are or where they are. Certainly, some unidentified projects will be discovered and put into production, but we really don't know where or in what quantity. So what I take away from this slide is we, as a nation, the United States, has a faith-based energy policy. I mentioned a moment ago that the oil industry needs high prices today in order to function, and this is a new development. Just a decade ago, the oil industry was fine with oil at $15, $20 a barrel. That was incentive enough to go out and look for new sources of oil. No more. Now that it's in order to find new oil, it's necessary to drill in deep water or to hydrofrack low porosity shales in order to get the oil out. The oil industry needs prices of $80 and rising rapidly. Even that number may be obsolete. It may be more like $87 these days. That's a number that I heard just this summer. But it's a moving target because, $20 to $87 in under a decade, that's a pretty rapid trajectory, right? Meanwhile, economic analysis by people like James Hamilton at the University of California, San Diego, suggests that when we have oil prices in the inflation-adjusted range of $100 a barrel and they stay there for very long, the economy starts to go haywire. As you can see, every time we've had an oil price spike, we've had a recession immediately follow. Right? So if the oil price that the industry needs is growing that rapid, there isn't much leeway here anymore, is there? So it's foreseeable that within the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, we'll be in a situation where the oil industry will need economy-killing oil prices just to make it worthwhile to go out and look for more oil. And if they don't go out and look for more oil, that means we won't have enough oil, and the price of oil will go up until it kills the economy. And if it kills the economy, that means that people won't be able to afford to drive cars, so the demand for oil will go down, the price of oil will decline temporarily enough so that the oil industry, you get the picture. This has already happened once. It happened in 2008. The price of oil spiked to almost $150 a barrel, and the economy crashed, so demand for oil plummeted in the U.S., and that drove down the price. So by August 2008, the price was $150. December 2008, the price was $35. And it's recovered since then, as the economy has, quote, recovered. So how big a deal is this? Well, it's, you know, we're talking about the fuel of modern industrial civilization. And very often, you know, when I'm doing like radio interviews, somebody will call in and say, oh, but can't we just replace oil with solar panels? And I have to, what? No, yes, well, solar panels, good idea. Yes, we need more solar panels, but they make electricity. And how many electric cars do we actually have? Well, it's going to take us a long time just till we get to a point where most of the cars on the market available for sale are electric cars. And then once we get to that point, and it'll take us another 20 years before everybody has, you know, traded in their old one. So for the foreseeable future, transportation means liquid fuels, period. And we're never going to have electric airliners because the batteries would be so heavy they wouldn't be able to get off the ground. The more serious situation is with food. And of course, transportation is implicated there too, because a lot of food gets transported. I just got back from Hawaii a couple of weeks ago, speaking in Honolulu, and I was amazed and frightened to discover that Hawaii imports 85% of its food. It has some of the best soil of any place you could imagine, but they import 85% of their food, and over 90% of their electricity is generated from diesel fuel and bunker oil. Talk about vulnerability. Now, they could be producing all of their energy from renewables, and they could be growing all of their own food, but where are they in actuality? Well, maybe it's an extreme case, but we're all kind of in that boat, aren't we? How much of Mendocino's food is grown locally? I hear 8%, 3%. Yeah, not much. Well, what's happened, of course, over the past few years is that food prices and fuel prices have started moving in tandem. And it's pretty easy to understand why that is, because we built a food system that's so dependent on oil for transporting inputs to the farm and outputs from the farm ultimately to the consumer's plate, maybe 1,500 miles on average. And then those farm inputs in many cases are pesticides, herbicides made from oil, or fertilizers made from natural gas. So our agriculture has become totally oil dependent, and that's the main reason these prices are moving in tandem. Food prices have actually been outpacing fuel prices. So what's the added factor? Well, maybe a bit of speculation, but it's mostly weird weather. So if food prices and fuel prices are rising, who does that impact first and foremost? Poor people. And poor people in poor countries, you know, people who have to pay a very large proportion of their meager incomes for food. You know, if the price of wheat or rice doubles, what does that mean for the average North American? Well, not that much. But if half of your salary goes toward food and you're eating very simple foods, you know, you're not eating a lot of canned and frozen foods and so on, but just, you know, you're boiling garbanzo beans and rice or grains, then if the cost of those staples doubles, that means you're eating less. So people in those situations find they suddenly have nothing left to lose. They may be people who have been laboring for years under autocratic regimes in countries with extreme inequality of wealth. But they were willing to put up with those conditions because, first of all, they knew if they protested that the government's response would be draconian. And second, because there was always the promise of economic growth. A rising tide would ultimately lift all boats, and in some distant future, we'll all be rich. And the saying became, in China, to be rich is to be glorious. To be rich is glorious. Well, when economic growth stops and food and fuel prices rise, then suddenly people in poor countries have nothing left to lose, and they go out on the street and overthrow regimes. And this is what happened with the Arab Spring. Now, I talked about fossil fuel depletion, but fossil fuels are not the only non-renewable resources that are depleting rapidly. This is a short list of minerals that happen to be useful in the computer industry and the renewable energy industry. Up until about the year 2000, most of these minerals were actually getting cheaper year after year. That's kind of counterintuitive, right? Because we're talking about non-renewable resources and we're depleting them. Why should they be getting cheaper? Well, the answer is we were using more cheap energy to dig deeper, to refine lower grade ores, and to globalize the whole process of resource exploration and extraction and trade. So copper was getting cheaper, bauxite was getting cheaper, and so on. Since about the year 2000, as oil has become more expensive, the price of most of these other non-renewable resources has also gone up substantially. So we're seeing scarcity not just of oil, but also of other things. Our energy infrastructure is slow and expensive to change. It's not like inventing a new electronic device like a cell phone or a smartphone or an iPad or something like that. Suddenly, the world has changed with this new product, and you know, in the course of a few months, our consciousness changes and buying habits and all that sort of thing. No, our energy infrastructure consists of thousands and thousands of coal power plants and natural gas power plants, a billion cars and trucks across the planet that have an average lifetime of 25 years or so. It takes decades and trillions of dollars to change out our energy infrastructure. We will do that. We must do it. But it's not something that can happen overnight. Okay, I've talked about the first two D's, debt and depletion. What about disaster? Well, I mentioned earlier the weird weather that we're seeing. And I know in this country you're not supposed to talk about climate change because half of us or more don't believe that it exists. But something sure is happening because the insurance companies are worried as heck. You know, they no longer know how to value risk. 100-year floods are now happening every 5 years. 100-year droughts are now happening every 7 years. So what the hell is going on? Nobody can say for sure, but it might have something to do with the fact that we're taking hundreds of billions of tons of carbon from where it was stored under the Earth's surface and pumping into the atmosphere in history's greatest science experiment just to see what'll happen. What is happening is pretty scary. And not only is the weather changing, and not only are we seeing record droughts and floods and fires, but also we're seeing industrial accidents on a scale that we've never seen before. You know, we're in the era of extreme energy. We've used the cheap, easy oil that we produce from onshore in shallow reservoirs. Now we have to, again, drill deeper and drill in inconvenient and difficult places. So we're operating at the very limits of our technical ability. And that means that things will go wrong. And when they do go wrong, if you're drilling in a couple of miles of ocean water, things can go very wrong indeed for whole ecosystems. We're on this runaway train. It started moving a century or two ago, and it's been picking up speed at, you know, just 2 or 3 or 4% per year, nothing very remarkable. But we've gotten used to it speeding up and accelerating. And we want it to accelerate all the time because As it does, that means more jobs and higher returns on investment. And so we want the folks who are in charge of the train to continue shoveling fuel into the locomotive sufficiently so that it will continue to accelerate. And as it accelerates, we feel really good. I mean, we feel the wind in our face and our hair, and it's exhilarating. And of course, there's all this smoke billowing out of the smokestack. And if you happen to look behind, it looks horrible. It's just, you know, covering everything. But we're not interested in looking behind. We want to look forward because we want to know what's going to happen to us in the glorious future that awaits us as our economy continues to grow and the train goes forward and faster all the... But the reality is we live on a planet that is finite, that has limited resources, limited fresh water, limited fish in the ocean, limited fossil fuels, and all the rest. So those limits, as I hope I've convinced you by now, at least in theory, those limits are not far in the distance, and they are not just theoretical. We are hitting those limits now, and that's why we're seeing the economy doing what it is doing. We are facing a growth crisis. Now, what just happened yesterday? The world's central banks got together and they created an enormous amount of liquidity for the banks in Europe and the US principally. Why did they do that? Well, I'm going to suggest they wouldn't have done that if they weren't extremely worried about a credit crisis over the short term of probably at least as great a severity as what we saw in September 2008. We have been building up a very serious problem in the European nations, particularly Greece, Portugal, Italy, and soon France. Now, what's the problem? Well, it's a growth crisis. You know, much of this debt could have been repaid if the economy had continued to grow at rates that we were seeing, you know, 5 or 7 years ago. But as the economy slowed, then suddenly all of this sovereign debt, especially on the part of countries like Ireland and Greece and Portugal and so on, suddenly all of that debt became unrepayable. And the banks who were holding those bonds, who were holding those debts, suddenly were holding assets that were worth much less than what they thought they were. So this means that those banks are functionally insolvent. That's not a problem that the central banks can actually solve. What the central banks can do is provide short-term liquidity for them by giving them really, really cheap loans. The way I put it is there is a row of dominoes right now, stretching from Athens to Rome to Wall Street to Washington to Beijing. And those dominoes will topple. Exactly when, exactly under what circumstances, and with what speed, we don't know. But the fact is that the assets of the financial industry are, to use an overused word at this point, toxic. What does that mean? Within the housing bubble of the last few years, as real estate inflated in prices, homeowners by the millions took out second mortgages and home equity lines of credit based on those inflated real estate values. Now that the values of the real estate have plummeted, most of those loans are still on the books of the banks at the previous value. Those assets of the banks are, in many cases, functionally worthless. But that fact has been hidden by the Treasury and the Federal Reserve acting in concert because they don't want the banks to go bust. They don't want the financial system to come apart. And so it's been patched, and the problem has been put off to the future. And trillions in taxpayer dollars have been used to paper over the situation temporarily. So in this book, The End of Growth, is one that I worked on for some time. I interviewed about three dozen people, including a number of financial experts, former managing director of J.P. Morgan, former hedge fund managers, former vice president of Lehman Brothers. I like talking, whether it's petroleum geologists or bankers, I like talking to retired people. Because they tend to know where the bodies are buried, and they're free to talk about it. And those folks almost all agreed that this is where we are today. This is what we have to look forward to. What we do have to look forward to is, I think, this word, austerity. Now, over the past 3-4 years, what we've seen is the Keynesian solution. Governments have borrowed and spent in order to restart the economy, to restart growth. And we did buy ourselves a fairly anemic and fairly short recovery. It was really expensive, but we did manage to go out and buy one. But it's pretty much over, and we've kind of run out of ammunition or fuel or whatever metaphor you want to use. So now the new tactic is austerity. Now, what is austerity exactly? Well, it's cutbacks in government spending, right? And we have politicians out there saying, by golly, this is what we've got to do, and if we just cut government spending enough, what'll happen? Well, the, by golly, private industry will leap into the fray and start creating jobs and making more economic growth happen. Is that really what's going to occur? Well, we have experiments going on right now. Look at what's going on in Greece and Ireland. They have implemented austerity packages. They've been required to by the rest of the EU in order to get their banks, their government bailed out. And what do we see in those countries? We see economic output plummeting much faster than would have been the case without the austerity packages. So we can anticipate exactly the same thing happening in this country when we do see substantial cutbacks in government spending. The result is the air is going to be sucked out of the room, and we will see increasing unemployment, higher levels of real estate defaults, and so on. So just as we saw in the Middle East and North Africa, people who suddenly have nothing left to lose and are willing to go out in the street and protest, we have the same thing going on here. And of course, it's called the Occupy movement. And it has the force of history behind it, because inevitably, as more people are suffering economic ruin, more people will be forced to go out in the street and protest. But also, I think it's an enormous opportunity, because remember, I talked earlier about how Wall Street corrupted Washington as if it needed that much help, and which then helped Wall Street corrupt itself even further. So we've got into this situation where basically all three branches of government are implicated in systemic corruption. Now, I use the word corruption, and usually when we use that word, we mean a few bad actors breaking the rules, right? That's not the situation now. The rules have been changed, so that what used to be illegal is now perfectly legal. It's perfectly normal as a result of Supreme Court decisions, as a result of laws changed by Congress. Things that used to be illegal on Wall Street are now perfectly legal. And the buying and selling of politicians by corporations and by Wall Street used to be illegal, now perfectly okay. Okay. So how do you change that? If the whole system has been corrupted, you have to do something from outside the system. And I think that's what the Occupy movement is effectively is attempting to do. And I think it's really our only hope of removing the roadblock to the kinds of action that so many of us have known for so long are actually needed. fundamental changes in our agricultural policies, our transport policies, our energy policy. Basically, whoever gets elected to be president of the United States right now is working for Wall Street. They have their marching orders. Doesn't matter if they're smart people or dumb people, nice people or nasty people. That's the job, to run the country on behalf of Wall Street. So until that changes, you know, signing petitions and voting for the other party and doing all of these sorts of things are not going to change very much. So, you know, we're going to have to stir things up. And I think it's really wonderful. I've visited a number of the Occupy encampments in Santa Rosa and Honolulu and Portland, Oregon, and other places. And I see tens of thousands of young people getting a political education. And it's really remarkable. You know, they are engaging in classes. They have, you know, if somebody wants to give a class on something, they just do it. They're assembling libraries of good books. You know, the Occupy Wall Street Library got raided. It had 5,000 books. That's a pretty good, you know, pretty good little library there. So, you know, the media likes to portray this as a sort of, you know, flash in the pan, and the police roust them and make them take down their tents, and so that's the end of the Occupy movement, right? No. The tactics are going to change. This is going to evolve. It could get nasty. I mean, if the people in power feel that they are genuinely threatened, it could get very ugly. But people are not going to give up, because what are we fighting about here? It's really fundamentally the direction of our country, economic survival, democracy itself. You know, as we go through this transition of the 21st century that we're all going to be participating in for the rest of our lives, whether we're 17 years old or 70 years old, the rest of our lives is going to be lived under these in the process of this transition. What are we going to be doing? Well, among other things, we're going to have to change our goals as a society. If economic growth in GDP is no longer possible, we have to find new measures, new goals, new targets. There are lots of things that actually we have sacrificed for economic growth. The quality of our community, the quality in many cases of our family life, because, you know, it was more important to work for money so that we would have the money to pay somebody else to do things for us that friends and family used to do, right? We've commoditized as much as possible in order to create the maximum amount of economic growth. If you're paying people to do stuff, that helps economic growth. If they're volunteering, that doesn't help economic growth. So guess, you know, what we've been doing. We could be happier. We could have higher quality community life if that's what we aim for, if that's what we target, if that's what we value, right? And economists know that GDP is a faulty indicator, but they fall back on it because it's so simple and they're familiar with it. But as it becomes clear that GDP growth is just no longer in the cards, no matter what we do, I think we will see alternative indicators come to the fore. And in the book, I talk about a number of them, including gross national happiness, the genuine progress indicator, and others. So another thing we have to do is build local resilience. I emphasize local because as transport fuels become more scarce and expensive, we will be less mobile, and it will become more expensive to import stuff. So that means we've got to make stuff and repair stuff locally. And this especially applies to food. We have to produce more of our own food. It's not only food systems, also transport systems. How do people get around in this community? Do you have any good public transportation? Probably not much, is my guess. Well, you know, if and when gasoline gets really expensive and folks find their pockets empty, because their bank accounts suddenly have been frozen by Wall Street or who knows what, how are folks going to get around? Well, you're going to have to put more people in the existing cars. That's the cheapest and fastest way to increase per passenger vehicle fuel efficiency. Just put another passenger in the car, right? So car share and ride share programs, the fastest, most effective way of adapting. We're also going to have to reform economics itself. You know, economics as a discipline grew up during this past anomalous century of economic growth. So economists looked at what was going on and they internalized it and they drew conclusions about it that in many cases are really absurd. You know, economists have come to the belief, the shared belief, that all of nature is just a pile of resources that we feed into the economic engine, and out come products which then become waste. That's the only function of the natural world in the economists' equations. Well, in fact, of course, the entire human economy is just a subset of the ecosystem of nature. And if nature does not survive, the human economy does not survive. It's that simple. So we have to get it straight. Growth in population and consumption levels is fundamentally not sustainable. You can do it for a while, and we have done it for decades now. We've grown population and we've grown per capita consumption levels. But can you do it forever? No. So we have to figure out what is enough. What is sufficient? What's the cutoff point? What's our goal? How big an economy do we want to have? What does a mature economy look like, as opposed to a rapidly growing adolescent economy, you know, that just wants everything right now? Economists don't ask that question. We have to understand that renewable resources have to be harvested at less than the rate of natural replenishment. This is an idea that any intelligent 10-year-old can understand. A PhD economist takes a little longer, but it still is possible. And non-renewable resources have to be recycled wherever possible, and the rate at which we extract them has to decline. Okay, very, very simple principles. Now, question. Can we follow those principles and still build a smartphone? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know anybody who doesn't know the answer to that question, but isn't it an interesting question, and shouldn't we be asking it? If this is, in fact, the coolest thing that any human being has ever owned or used, and if we want it to continue to be the center of our lives, then can we afford to have them made by people on the other side of the planet working for slave labor wages, working in conditions of absolute misery and pollution, using rapidly depleting, scarce, non-renewable resources? You know, this is something that is unsustainable, right, in principle. So either we got to figure out how to make them using local, well-paid labor and renewable resources, or we have to start imagining what life would be without them. I'm suggesting everywhere I go that a good idea would be to create a community economic laboratory. And that's just a place in town that brings together all of the alternative economic experiments that are already going on within the community. And here in Mendocino, I think, you know, you have a lot of these, and they're already pretty prominent within the community. A lot of places I go, it's not that way, and they're very, you know, this stuff is very much on the fringe. But I think it really needs to be brought into the middle of town, put into a building that everybody can see and recognize, because these things are going to become the mainstream economy over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. As the big bank goes bust, where are you going to do your banking, if not at the local credit union? You know, as it gets more expensive to operate your own personal motor car, Where are you going to go to join a car share, ride share program? We need all of this stuff happening right in the middle of town. We want to make sure that everybody in town knows where to go to volunteer, because volunteerism is going to be a much, much bigger deal as time goes on, as we can no longer afford to pay people to do stuff for us that we would like them to do. And, you know, if we're not paying to do stuff for us that we need done, that means we're going to have to be nice to people and do stuff for them, too. Sharing is going to become a lot more important. And as we do these things, you know, actually life can become better. When people in their 90s look back at the Great Depression, this is what they recall. They recall an economy in which we did stuff for each other and we shared. And we didn't have very much, but very often we had really good times. And better times, in fact, than in later decades when money was easier. So I'm going to end by suggesting that what we're going through over the course of the next few years and few decades may, in the end, be as important a transition in our history as a species as any of the fundamental transitions that have made us who and what we are as human beings, like the harnessing of fire, starting maybe 3 or 4 million years ago, that enabled us to cook our food. The advent of language that enabled us to coordinate our behavior across space and time. Imagine bringing down a mastodon with your group of friends if you couldn't talk to one another, if you couldn't communicate in some way, you know? But if you could say, hey, look, I've got this spear, I'm gonna hide behind this bush, you scare it and make it go this way, and then we'll jump out. And so language gave us enormous power over our environment that we didn't have previously. So did agriculture. You know, the ability to grow surplus grain, storable grains, gave us full-time division of labor. Civilization itself, urbanization, writing, mathematics, all came from agriculture just 10,000 years ago. And then the industrial fossil fuel revolution gave us even more power over the environment. And our population bloomed from fewer than 1 billion to 7 billion in just 200 years. Okay, well, we've kind of come to the end of that trajectory, a trajectory of becoming bigger and more powerful, and having greater and greater impact on our environment. We can't do much more of the same. But what will happen? Where do we go now? Well, I don't have a name for this next chapter in human history, because I think that maybe would be too confining. Who am I to come up with a name for it anyway? But I can guess that it's the transition is going to be to a way of life that takes into account nature's limits. It's as though we are finally growing up as a species, becoming mature, recognizing our own mortality as a species, if you will, recognizing that we have to live within limits if we're going to survive. So what an extraordinary time to be alive, you know, to know that we will be recreating all of the fundamental systems of human society, how we feed ourselves, how we transport ourselves, the basis of trade. We'll probably be reinventing money as we go along. All of these things, what an extraordinary opportunity. So there are a lot of challenges before us, there's no question, but I think it's really important as we face those challenges, not to panic, but to look one another in the eye and nod and say, yeah, we can do this together. Thank you.